Let me introduce our panel here. We have three folks. All of them are members of the Board on Research Data and Information, and going from the far end of the table there, we have Robert Chen from Columbia University, Stephen Friend from the SAGE BioNetworks project, and Ann Wolpert, the university librarian at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. The focus of this second session is about key stakeholder groups and how to engage them. And I think you already probably picked up some themes in the first discussion that will reemerge here. In particular, the constant tension between disciplinary or subdisciplinary data silos and really broad interoperability and reuse. That's a problem that really is intrinsic, and I suspect in all these efforts we will always struggle to find the right balance for. But there are stakeholders we've not talked much about. I don't think we've actually mentioned libraries yet today. And indeed, research libraries are a very important player, for example, in this landscape. They are, I think we will come to see one of the real forces for sustainability here. Across time. That's one of the things that they do. So I will invite our panelists, and we'll just work across Bob, Stephen, and Ann to make some remarks, and then we will open it up for questions and conversation.
Is this on already? Okay. Yeah, well, I've discovered that a lot of the points I wanted to make has already been raised, so apologize for any repetition. And I knew this was going to be a late afternoon talk, so I'm hope you'll find my approach here a little different from the past speakers. But now you've had this teaser here for now a couple minutes, so why don't you, can I click it? Yeah. So here is the cartoon that goes with the title there. If you are a fan, I hope, of the XKCD comics, I have five of them that you'll see. And this one, I think, is appropriate because, we're evolutionarily prepared to, process as much data focusing on our iPads and stuff. I mean, that wasn't something we were trained for, as those of you who had, carpal tunnel syndrome or other modern maladies realize. And, we were asked to talk about stakeholders. So, I mean, the reason I feel this way is that, we're in the middle of a very rapid technological change in capabilities and the volume and the complexity of data. I run a data center and a research center at Columbia. We have projects that are, for example, building a relational database with 200 million records, one for every square kilometer of the land of the planet, to link population and building data for the Global Earthquake Model Initiative. We're part of a data net funded by NSF called Terra Populous, which is trying to build a resource covering census data on somewhere upward of 2 billion people that are potentially going to be incorporated. Now, big data is relative to every discipline, and big data in the social sciences is probably not as big as big data in astronomy and so forth. But certainly working in the environmental sciences, this is another XKCD comic. I don't know if you can read it, but those are planets, and somewhere, I think he says, that's our solar system. And so, I don't even know how up to date this is, but you know, just think of all the data on our planet multiplied by at least 786, although obviously there may not be as many, you know, 7 billion people on them or whatever. But, you know, it's also an exciting time. We're really flooded with data and looking ahead to a flood of data. And things that have helped are, for example, the, you know, the cost of storage. Steve Ruggles at Minnesota has a little graph, which I didn't put up, but I mean, showing that even in the last decade, our cost of storage has gone down by 2-3 orders of magnitude. And the cost of, you know, what we could do 20 or 30 years ago is, you know, used to cost millions to have the kind of, you know, 16 gigabyte chip in your phone that, you know, might cost $10 or something. So, you know, we can do a whole lot more than we could. And I think the point's been made that big data isn't just for scientists. It's also important for decision making. It's important in everyday life. People are using GPSs. This is actually, the link there is to a meme. It's been an internet meme evolving over the last 6 months, so I hope you've seen this before, but I really like this graph. And I think it also reflects something about big data that, you know, we also have to think about, which is, you know, it's at the edge of some actually, you know, not just potential opportunities, but I think some potential big problems or catastrophes, I mean, in terms of privacy, in terms of, you know, it just getting out of hand, in terms of all sorts of things that's, you know, under the surface of the Hulk. You know, so I think we also have to be cautious about what big data means, you know, not just for science, but also for society more generally. And there's a little side story, which is when I was putting this together, I've used this before, but we have to sign away rights to have this stuff up. And I spent over an hour looking for the rights for this, and the author's unknown, and, you know, there's no way to ascertain the rights. So at least that I found, if anybody knows who the author is, please let me know. No. No, I wish. No, I first saw this on Facebook, you know, and you know, the great thing about the SKCD is the person makes it available with a Creative Commons license. And so, you know, what you can find very quickly on the web and put together technologically, you're inhibited because the legal interoperability doesn't exist. And that's, I think, one of the big challenges that people face is that the whole set of intellectual property issues related to data and the incentives that are aligned with open data versus proprietary data and so forth is just a huge, not fully tapped arena. And you know, you can do great things putting data together, but if you can't use it, if you can't redistribute it, you know, one of my apocryphal stories was after the South Asian tsunami, a number of private remote sensing companies were very, very kindly made data available to in the emergency response. But then after the immediate crisis, they actually asked people in the field at the UN and NGOs to, quote, give the data back. You know, this idea that somehow, once the data's out and, you know, the genie's out of the bottle, you can get it back. I mean, that was one thing. But the other idea that, you know, it's okay to save, you know, to share data because you're saving people who just had a big crisis. Yet, in fact, the value of that data in rebuilding and reconstruction and the longer-term redevelopment, you know, where actually more lives are at risk in that phase in a disaster, but you wouldn't want to share data openly then, you know, is just a little strange. And so we have a lot of these contradictions, I think, in the community in thinking about these big data issues. So, you know, this goes to the theme that technology both enables us but also is frustrating. I mean, this one is obviously a recent one, but and the little, when you mouse over on the website, it actually says, yeah, you know, the web, it was the network that was the barrier in this case. But you know, obviously, what people take now for granted, that these cool things happen, you can do amazing things with probes on Mars, is balanced by the fact that, you know, when the whole world is looking, then the things we take for granted, our internet bandwidth and so forth, don't always work right. And I think one of the interesting things about this idea of a global data infrastructure is that infrastructure has to be scaled to the potential use. And you know, although I, on the one hand, I'm very supportive of the kind of grassroots efforts and the voluntary things, lots of times you have trouble scaling those from the great thing that worked, you know, for a scientific community or problem to something that will actually be useful and reliable for, you know, prime time and actually be able to support not just the immediate science, but, you know, well, we had a talk at lunch about, you know, very rapid adaptive tornado forecasting. And when you get to those kinds of applications, then people's lives depend on it. The data, you know, is decisions are being made on very rapid turnaround, on very rapid production. You can't afford, you know, big errors cropping up or systems crashing or, and you also have all sorts of liability and other legal issues that those sorts of things raise. So, you know, we do have to think not just about the technology, but about the infrastructure and the support and the kinds of institutional and other mechanisms needed. Someone already said, I think early on, you know, you can't wait for the perfect. You need to do things practical. On the other hand, you know, I love this one. I've been involved in a number of standards groups and bodies, but what you don't want to have happen, obviously, is a group coming along saying, well, I'm just going to have the perfect standard, and, of course, what it leads to is a proliferation. I think where a lot of useful work can be done, and it was just mentioned in the previous panel, is much more on getting people to formalize their vocabularies and work on the interoperability, not just of, you know, formats and things, but of their ontologies and their language, so that we don't have, so we can break the silos, not by forcing the silos to change their behavior, but by creating the digital bridges between the silos that sort of make them somewhat obsolete. And so I think that's certainly a role that, you know, a lot of people in the community are interested in, but don't necessarily have the skills and capabilities to do on their own. So last cartoon. Point is we don't. It's important not to duplicate things. One of my hats is as I'm just finishing up my eighth year as the Secretary General for CODATA, an international committee on data for science and technology. And we have many activities. John Rumble, our former president, did he have to leave? Oh no, there he is. Recently helped organize a workshop on description of nanomaterials and bringing together all sorts of communities, ISO, governments, industry, academics, from several different fields, all interested in. You know, you say nanomaterials, but there's still a very wide range of nanoscales embedded in that. And they had a very successful meeting in March in Paris, John? And came out with some, I think, interesting recommendations. The key one was, well, we need some groups to really follow up. And, you know, I think it's easy to hold the workshop and bring the right stakeholders together. What is hard, and I heard allusions to it, is to actually have the resources and the organization to really follow up and make those connections meaningful. And, you know, if the forum just goes and repeats having more workshops, I mean, we all get invited to too many, I think that would be negative because it really detracts from getting work done and all those other things. If the forum can build on, you know, existing efforts where you know, you already have 75 or 80% of the people there, and sure, another group needs to be brought in, but there's follow-up, I think that would benefit the community a lot more. So and that gets to the bottom line. This might not be the most politically correct cartoon, but anyway, you know. you know, in order to get the next generation, we're going to have to spend money. Voluntary activities by the stakeholder community has its limits. What I worry about a lot, and you see it, voluntary efforts actually, on the one hand, benefit the haves who have the time and the funding to go and fund themselves to go to meetings and fund themselves to do things internationally. And the part of the community that misses out are all the people who really just don't have the time. They're focused on raising their funds or teaching or whatever. They really don't have the luxury of participating in these activities. And so until you can level the playing field a bit with funding the haves, and in some cases the haves and have-nots are disciplines, you know, the social scientists don't get brought in because they don't have the kind of big projects that astronomy or earth sciences have, you know, you're going to get these disparities. So I think, you know, one of the things I would urge is to really think how getting the funders to help balance the playing field and get more involvement would make a difference in this, and, you know, allow us to build an infrastructure that really has persistence and robustness for you know, a very broad community of stakeholders, which includes, you know, the scientists as well as all those different kinds of end users. So I'll stop there. Thanks.